Journalists face daily attacks from all levels of government. It's even tougher for Latinas trying to establish their voice. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today we're going to talk to two of the biggest Latina journalists in the industry. Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA, and Alicia Menendez, the new co-host of the PBS program Amanpour & Company. They'll discuss everything from immigration, Puerto Rico, and the Me Too movement. Plus, in San Juan, there's a place called La Social, a popular hangout that includes a boutique, beauty salon, and coffee shop. The owner suffered a lot after Hurricane Maria and decided to bring their idea to Miami. We'll talk with Ivan Nieves and David Torres about trying to bring that one-stop social from the island to the Magic City.
That's one of the things as a Puerto Rican. Like, we create our family no matter where we are.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The politics surrounding the true death toll in Puerto Rico continues to be complicated. Following the president's comments on Friday, a number of Republican Florida politicians have spoken against the president, including gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis. The acting FEMA administrator Brock Long took a different approach in speaking with NBC's Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday.
The numbers are all over the place. FEMA doesn't count deaths. And if you take what's going on with Florence, the deaths that are verified by the local county coroners are the ones that we take.
Again, the bulk was from interruption of medical care, which you're trying to take care of in Florence. They interviewed people from FEMA to come up with that number. So who's right? The president who says those deaths didn't happen or the FEMA officials who helped GW put together that report?
Yeah, I don't know who they interviewed within my agency. They may have looked at funeral benefits to help, you know, calculate whatever number. And that's a number, you know, that's the only number that we would really be able to contribute to any study going forward.
Well, it's one of the many stories impacting the Latino population in the U.S. Also like this one, children are still being separated from their parents. But with that, we've also seen more immigrant activists speaking up and fighting back. And these stories are becoming more abundant in news coverage. Now, one journalist who's been covering the issue for years is Maria Hinojosa, considered one of the most prominent Latina journalists in the U.S. She founded the Harlem-based nonprofit production company Futuro Media Group and started a one-hour-long show, NPR's Latino USA, devoted to highlighting the Latino voice of the U.S. That show, by the way, airs on WLRN Friday nights at 8. Hinojosa is speaking today at Florida Atlantic University about immigration and the First Amendment as part of a series of events by the university for Constitution Day. And we talked this morning. She was at the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. And we started by talking about the story coming out of Puerto Rico. Why did Latino USA want to do that story in Puerto Rico?
Well, we are we cover Latino and Latina issues in the United States and have been doing it for 25 years. I mean, we've been going down to Puerto Rico for the past 25 years, not as often as I would like, but we have been there pretty consistently. So when this happened and we saw that the story of Hurricane Maria was basically being passed over for the next big political story, and we were getting the information about people suffering on the island, you know, complete blackouts. I mean, we've been through this before, and we were watching. As journalists, we were seeing that, you know, major networks were just not paying attention. Now, some of them made a decision to plant their feet as a journalistic commitment to telling American stories. Like, for example, David Begno of CBS News, or like us. And we did that because we are passionate American journalists. And we have a commitment to shining a light where it's not being shown. And in particular, covering and anchoring Latino USA, we have a particular responsibility to talk about Latino and Latinas in the United States. And Puerto Ricans are a huge, important part of our story. And so how could we not, I guess, was the question. What's been interesting, Luis, is how many other people who have kind of begun to cover Puerto Rico, and now they realize, like, how hard it is to get support and to get places to air our coverage, because it is, you know, in many ways, a forgotten island.
And you talk about so many Latinos in the United States, a lot of Puerto Ricans who have come to the mainland, even before, after, you know, the aftermath of Maria. But I wanted to turn that into this is, you know, obviously a lot of people have talked about the Trump tweet from last week when that number came out. Again, you know, not direct impact of deaths to the hurricane, but the deaths you know, months after the hurricane. And of course, he had his tweet that was very controversial. The interesting part of that, though, I wanted to ask you is you have two prominent Republicans running for offices in Florida, Rick Scott running for Senate, Ron DeSantis running for governor, and they had to dispute what the president said, though they need his support. How do you think the Puerto Rican voice is going to play out in November in Florida?
Look, I was fascinated by what just happened with those comments and kind of jumping in and criticizing the president, Republicans in the state of Florida. I have said that the Puerto Ricans of the state of Florida, in some particular areas like Central Florida, are the most powerful Puerto Ricans in the world, literally in the world. In many ways, they are holding the future of presidential elections in their hands because they can swing the state of Florida. And if Florida swings, that says everything. I also feel like sometimes I have a tremendous amount of my own passion for seeing Puerto Rican voters because I just, you know, I mean, you're American citizens. Oh, my God, you've got to vote. And that sometimes I'm not sure how I want to categorize this, but I get very enthusiastic about the expectations. And I think we have to be clear, one, that Puerto Ricans who are leaving the island and coming here have got a lot of issues on their mind. This has been a traumatic experience from top to bottom. And so for us to have the expectation that they're going to arrive here and in between trying to find a new job, getting kids into school, et cetera, that they're going to find the time to register. And, you know, so that means that people have got to be doing ridiculous amounts of outreach to get to them because we cannot put the expectation on them to handle one more thing after being through a tremendous amount of trauma. I also think that the politics on the island are different than the politics in the mainland, right? That they don't align specifically Republican and Democrat, but much more around around the statehood or independence or status quo issue. That complicates matters. So is there a possibility for a tremendous amount of impact if Puerto Ricans, displaced Puerto Ricans and those already in the state of Florida take to the polls, you know, in a month or so? Oh, absolutely. I'm just waiting for that day. I mean, you can sense the excitement. I'm just like, oh my God, I can't wait until that happens. On the other hand, I need to take a breath. I think we all do and have to say there's a lot of work that needs to be done on the side of reaching these Puerto Rican potential voters.
I wanted to move over to the fact that you are here today at Florida Atlantic University to talk about immigration and the First Amendment. We've seen, you know, in the past year, a spike in family separation at the border. And in early June here in South Florida, you know, the news had broke that there was a homestead detention facility holding up to 1,000 immigrant children. A lot of cases have gone to court. All of this has called attention, of course, to the legal rights of immigrants in the U.S. First, are any constitutional rights like the First Amendment granted to undocumented immigrants in detention?
No. In fact, we have the story of the Dream Nine. These are nine activists who, dreamers who ended up in detention in a civil disobedience act. And when two of the women, young women who were in detention, stood up inside the detention facility, and because they were being isolated, they were not being allowed to talk to any of the other detainees. And when they stood up and kind of stood up on the tables in the cafeteria and they were like, look, we just want to talk to you. You have rights. You know, you have legal rights. Call lawyers. The guards in the facility immediately took them down forcibly and put them into solitary confinement. So this is the opposite of freedom of speech. That was exactly my point in wanting to cover that particular part of the story, because that is supposedly their right to have freedom of speech in the United States. And yet they were not just told to come down and, you know, stop doing that. No, they were put into solitary confinement. They were punished for using their voices. And frankly, I could be one of them. I was not born in this country. And what's happened now is that the litmus test in between how people are treated and the rights we have been reduced to whether or not you were born in this country. If you were born in this country, yes, you have all rights afforded to you. If you were not, either if you're undocumented, if you're an immigrant with a green card, or if you're an immigrant like me who has become an American citizen, all of those things are now in play. And so what happens when you're detained is you are not read your rights. You don't have no due process. You are coerced. You have you're not assigned a lawyer. So when we talk about rights being denied to immigrants when they are in the process of being detained in a civil procedure, not a criminal one, because all immigration is civil, now we have no rights. And no one has been listening to the clamor of journalists and lawyers who have been saying, if you deny due process and rights, you know, First Amendment rights to people on any kind of a basis, we open the door to those rights being denied to all of us. Hey,
I'm speaking with Maria Hinojosa, anchor and executive director of NPR's Latino USA, a show you can hear on WLRN Friday nights at 8. She's talking today at Florida Atlantic University about immigration and the First Amendment as part of a series of events by the university for Constitution Day. We've seen from this, as you know, a lot of undocumented immigrants who've come out of the shadows, they've started participating in activism now. But, you know, have we seen through the Trump administration's more active policy of deportation a greater threat posed to these individuals?
Yes, no doubt. We have been documenting cases on Latino USA where we are talking to community-based activists who believe that they have been targeted for detention and deportation because of the fact that they are activists. We have been reporting on journalists who are undocumented professional journalists who have been taken into detention.
Are they being followed? Are they being tracked? Are they being watched? Is there a list?
That's a really great question. I don't have any proof that there's a list. I would not be surprised if there's a list. I think we are witnessing horrors in our country that are really hard for us to kind of get a handle on. And so, you know, when people say, oh, no, 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 that couldn't happen. Oh, no, no, they wouldn't have a list of activists and journalists who are, you know, immigrants. No, no, no. And then it's like, you know, we would have said, no, there's no way that they would ever put a baby in a cage. There's no way that we would see a government that is purposefully keeping children away from their parents, and in some cases, permanently kidnapping these children from their parents and saying that it is for the safety of the child. Now we are seeing this in a very outward expression of a hatred towards us. And I know that your audience were kind of like, wait, what happened that we became enemy number one? How did that happen? And so we're trying to answer those stories by doing the best journalism that we can.
Before I let you go, I had to ask you for your comment on another story. This one on the recent op-ed by John Hockenberry, the former host of the program The Takeaway. Harper's Magazine published his editorial titled Exile, and he writes about how he was targeted by the women who accused him and that it is because of them that he has had his downfall in his career. You were very vocal in your criticism of the piece on Twitter. You knew him.
Let me see how I want to answer this. Because, you know, John Hockenberry never tried any of his shenanigans with me. I've known John Hockenberry since 1986. Never tried it with me. But I have known John Hockenberry since then. And so when he... Oh, my goodness, that article at Harper's Magazine. I think what I said, what really got me was, you know, here is a man who is a brilliant writer. He's a brilliant writer. Look, Picasso was a brilliant painter, but he was horrible to women. John Hockenberry is a brilliant writer, but he is completely living in a world of his own creation where he can write this and where Harper's gives him a platform to write that I'm a misunderstood romantic. He really doesn't understand the way he's talking to women and how it comes off, because he's so involved in his own ego that he just sees himself as a suffering man who had a horrible accident when he was 19. And why can't anybody see how much he is suffering and how much his heart wants to be loved? And it's not – look, human beings are complicated. I feel very, very sad for John Hockenberry. But you need to step out of yourself. And so this article did the absolute opposite of that. It did not – there was no kind of distance to say like, wow, my attitude, what I've done, my privilege. Wow, the fact that I get to even print this in Harper's Magazine and get I don't know how many thousands and thousands of words again, my question was, how about the women, those three women who I know, who were his co-anchors, to whom he was incredibly disrespectful? How about them? Where's their platform?
And what's your take on Harper Magazine publishing it? And do we give voice to people like this?
You know, I it makes me think a lot about the New York Times Magazine giving this extraordinary privilege of publishing an anonymous op-ed to somebody within this administration. Just like the extraordinary amount of privilege that comes with. And that I think that, again, if we're looking at newsrooms that are majority white, male run, that they don't even see the way in which they're extending that privilege. So I don't know the ins and outs of Harper's Magazine and how this came about, but the fact that they would kind of do this without saying, you know, in the same edition, we are going to ask any of the women to talk about their side of the story. It's just, again, it's kind of the cluelessness. And I guess, Lewis, if there is a silver lining to this terrible cloud of this moment in history that we are living, it is that a lot of people are owning their voice and their power. And so we are talking about these things. We are naming these things. The fact that I can respond, you know, on Twitter and engage with people and with Harper's about this, the fact that we don't put this genie back into the bottle, the fact that we are naming more things, whether it is, you know, lives being diminished or denied in Puerto Rico, or whether it's children being kept in a cage or a freezer because they were not born in this country, or if it's, you know, the way people talk about women's bodies, we're not silent, and we can't put this genie back into the bottle. And so, as hard as it was to say those things for me about somebody who I know, this is not a fun time for us. But again, we have to own our power. I was not going to be silent and let another man take control of the narrative, or another newsroom run by men to take control of this narrative.
Maria Hinojosa is the host and executive director of NPR's Latino USA, which, by the way, you can hear right here on WLRN Fridays at 8. She will be speaking today at Florida Atlantic University about immigration and the First Amendment as part of a series of events by the University for Constitution Day. Maria Hinojosa, it's such a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the time, Lewis. I really appreciate it.
And it was an absolute pleasure. And again, Latina USA is on WLRN Fridays at 8 p.m. Well, still to come, we're going to talk about a podcast with a focus on Latinas and the Latina life. All coming up next here on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Alicia Menendez is working to empower Latinas. She is a Miami-based journalist, contributing editor to Bustle Magazine, host of the podcast Latina to Latina, and she made her debut last week as a co-host to Amanpour & Company on PBS. Now, she started her podcast Latina to Latina last year, and there she has long-form interviews with Latina celebrities about their personal and professional struggles. Season 2 launched today with an interview with one of the Latina stars of Orange is the New Black. Alicia, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I like how when you said host and bustle, you wanted to make it hustle, which is like 90% of what I do. So that's very appropriate.
I meant to do that. Of course I did. You know what? This is interesting because you're usually doing the interviews and now you're the interviewee.
Yeah, I would much rather be asking the questions.
Just be careful if you throw me some my way. I'm not always prepared. You know what? Because you were sitting in here with me and we were listening to the interview with Maria Hinojosa.
And she's the best.
And it really did. I mean, I was trying to cover so much in such a short period of time, but really, you know, talking to her about her experiences as a Latina coming up in the business. And of course, she has that tie in with John Hockenberry. So much controversy with that and the Me Too movement, but she's been very vocal. I wondered your experiences as a Latina trying to come up in this industry. And, you know, what's that been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I always come at this from the vantage point of I am a Latina of the utmost privilege. I am white appearing. I have two college-educated, English-speaking citizen parents. I went to Harvard. Like, if it is not easy for me, then I do not know who it is easy for. And so one of the things that I've encountered very often in this business is that when you go into meetings, people feel like they have, like, one Latina spot. And they're like, well, you know, we already have a Latina. It's like, well, why not just hire me as a very talented journalist? That sometimes in the interest of thinking about diversity, diversity becomes the only lens through which someone sees you.
Do you get a sense that happens a lot? That's like, well, we've got our Latino over here. We've covered our diversity because we've got one of each or one of some, and then we're good, right? I mean, have you seen that?
I've seen it a fair amount. And listen, I may not be as talented as I think I am. It may be a question of merit, but it certainly has been part of my interpretation that that's part of the challenge. And it's part of the challenge for a lot of Latinos and Latinas who go into newsrooms, into talent meetings, wanting to be a part of a larger team, that sometimes we are not seen in our totality.
So you just started this new role as the co-host for Amanpour and Company on PBS. Tell us a little bit about what that role is and what you hope to accomplish with this.
It is a dream. I mean, it is long-form television interviews, which
is super rare.
And as you know, as a consumer of television, hard to come by. And what that means is if you get 4 minutes with a guest, you have to get in and out very quickly, especially if you have to get to all of the promotional things that they're there to tell you about. When you get 20 minutes with someone, you actually can start to get to the truth of who they are, to the complexity of their story. And so to me, it is such a privilege and such a luxury of time to have this. And part of what I see is my responsibility as the youngest host on the show, which at 35, it's nice to be the youngest anything. and as the Latina on the show, is to really think critically about who has influence, whose story is important enough to tell, and who we think of as someone who is changing the way we think about
things. Yeah, who are the people you want to talk to, in these long-form interviews?
I can tell you a little bit about the people I've already spoken to. So my first interview was with Michael Arsenault, who's New York Times bestselling author of the book I Can't Date Jesus, which is about his growing up Black, Catholic, and gay in Texas. This week, on Tuesday night, I interview Jose Antonio Vargas, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who came out a few years ago as being undocumented. And that's a great example of a story where if you're on cable, it has to be about sovereign borders and immigration policy. And those are certainly important conversations to have. But when you get 20 minutes with Jose, you can talk about what's it like when you're a 12-year-old kid who gets put on a plane by your mom and she promises she's going to follow you and she never does. What is it like to be an adult man who has no home? You know, those are things that you can really get to with a little bit more time.
And I'm wondering, are you looking for voices you don't tend to hear?
Yeah,
and especially in public media, which you think you'd hear more voices there than you would other places. But I'm trying to get a sense of like if there's a particular type of voice that you're looking for.
I think it is a person who has a platform and a voice off of television. So lots of these people have huge Twitter followings or huge Instagram followings. I interviewed Carla Welch, who's been named the most powerful stylist in Hollywood. She dresses all of these big Hollywood celebrities, and she's very political. And, you know, she has over 100,000 people who follow her on Instagram, but lots of people might just not know who she is. And so it's about, in some ways, crossing that divide between there are people who know her, really know her, and really admire her. How do you then bring that to a television audience?
What's interesting, too, is this, and I bring this back to what Maria Hinojosa was talking about with the Me Too movement. I mean, Amanpour and Company took over the time slot of the longtime CBS anchor Charlie Rose, again, accused of sexual misconduct at CBS, fired months after that. You know, within the Me Too movement, I'm curious, after all this happened, you know, you move into this position. I'm wondering, how often do you even talk about him, what he did, or the fact that, you know, this is where that, you know, his show used to be here, or that he used to be with this network? Or is all of that erased and you just don't even, like, no, we're going to push him aside. We're not even going to think about it. Move on.
Well, I would personally hope that none of it's erased and that we keep in the forefront of our mind the women who were brave enough to come forward with their accusations. And we honor the fact that many of them feel that their careers were derailed by some of these incidents. And at the same time, it's the start of something new, and we have to allow it to be something new, to lose a little bit of that comparative element and to say, if we were building a show from scratch, what would we want it to be? And so just the fact that it's not helmed just by one person, that there's a company around Christiane Amanpour, who's one of the most amazing journalists of my lifetime, is already a major change, because that's inviting more voices to the table from the get.
And you talk about not wanting to forget, but is it discussed? I mean, have there been changes? Do you get there's a sense of change in the industry that, you know, men and women can now talk to each other, and so we can, you know, we can admit what happened, but then we can say, let's not let that happen again? I mean, do you think that that's happening?
I don't know. And I think part of the reason I don't know that is because I don't sit in a newsroom every day. So I work remotely. I'm entering these places. I'm coming in. I'm doing my few interviews and then I'm leaving. I think it's a really good question, but a question that perhaps a woman who's in a newsroom 9 to 5 is better positioned to answer.
Again, I'm speaking with Alicia Menendez. She is a Miami-based journalist, contributor to Bustle Magazine, the host of the podcast Latina to Latina, and she made her debut last week as a contributor to Amanpour & Company on PBS. And we're talking about the many roles that she plays as a journalist based here in Miami, which I'm curious too, by the way, is that you stayed here in Miami, and I'm wondering why.
It gets its hooks in you.
It's a good way to put it.
My husband's from here. This, by the way, he is more excited about this hit on WLRN than he has ever been about any hit that I have ever done. So thank you for that. I'm now relevant in my own household.
I don't know what to say to that, but okay, all right.
My husband's from here, and his family's from here, and it's a big Cuban family, and so we have a lot of support here. And Miami is a wonderful place to live. It's a bit of a challenging place to work if you are a journalist, just because there aren't as many opportunities here as there might be in a New York or in LA. There's a quality of life that's just undeniable.
How does living here impact the way you approach a national story? How does Miami paint that?
So, for example, when I was covering temporary protected status and the fact that the Trump administration is going to be revoking temporary protected status for Haitian immigrants in particular, it was really important to me to talk to young people who have TPS. And because we're based here in Florida, there are a lot of young people who have TPS. And so in some ways, it just puts you a lot closer to the story than if you're sitting at a news desk somewhere and trying to find people. And I think also because I'm not in the news media bubble, it means that sometimes we have a little bit more perspective about what everyone is talking about.
Your podcast, Latina to Latina, you talk with successful Latinas about their personal, professional experiences. But where did the idea come from?
I had moved down to Miami originally to work at Fusion, which was the ABC Univision cable station in Doral. And because we had this association with Univision, we would get all of these amazing guests who'd come on Despierta America, and then they would roll over onto Fusion. And that meant that I interviewed a lot of Latinas, and that when I would sit down with them, we would have, you know, that very nice conversation you have with the mics on and the headsets on, and then the lights would go down, the mics would come off, and we would have this other conversation that's like, okay, but like, really, how are you doing? And that to me was always where the magic was, because there was an intimacy in that and a connection by virtue of being Latinas who were navigating professional spaces where we were one of the only or one of few. And I missed those conversations and thought to myself, how could I have them again and share them with more people? Because there were always nuggets of truth in those conversations that I would find myself repeating afterwards.
And then you had one, I was listening to it today, actually, the episode you did with Jackie Ruiz from Orange is the New Black. And you were talking to her about the growth of Latinos in different industries, music, movies, etc. Jackie Ruiz made a comment that about there's only one type of Latina representation being highlighted. Remind us about that part of the conversation.
Yeah, so Jackie Cruz from Orange is the New Black, she was talking about how she'd go into auditions and it always felt like she was not the right type of Latina, that they had something else in mind. What I find amazing is that as I interview Latina actors, as I interview Latina professionals, that comes up again and again. And so it blows my mind how all of us can be told we're not the right type of Latina. Because then I'm not sure who people are looking for. And it can mean a number of things. It can either mean we want someone who's not accented. We want someone who is accented. We wanted someone who wears hoops. We wanted someone with red lipstick. We wanted a blonde. That people have a notion in their mind of what a Latina is, what a Latina looks like, what a Latina sounds like. And it's not the same for everyone, but what it means is you're always measuring up against some type of invisible and ephemeral standard.
And, you know, that's interesting because I have a friend of mine who's a Latino actor, but, you know, he's been told many times, and you probably heard it from her, that, you know, your skin tone may not be the right tone mm-hmm. for what we're looking for because you don't look Latino enough, or why is your name Hispanic when you don't look like one? And then from Hispanics, they got mad at him because of the fact that, you know, you're taking parts from us, you know, wow. or you shouldn't even be here. But I mean, it was interesting that, yeah, and Cruz, I apologize that she would say that to you, that, you know, that's the challenge that they're facing. Where's that coming from? What's her take on where's that coming from?
We're a huge demographic. I mean, and we, I feel like
do you,
we oscillate
between. Do you think that
everybody
sees us as well? They're all Latinos. They're the same.
I don't think that everybody sees us any which way. I think that's sort of too big and sweeping a statement to make. But I do think that it depends on your exposure, right? So, like, I grew up in Union City, New Jersey, which is where the Cubans who didn't go to Miami went. We called it Havana on the Hudson. And by the time I was growing up, it was no longer majority Cuban. It was largely Puerto Rican, Dominican, Colombian. My vantage point growing up of being Latino was one, that it was a majority experience because everyone I knew and grew up with, we didn't call ourselves Latino, right? We called ourselves Cuban, Puerto Rican, but you know, later we would learn that we were all Latino. If you grow up in the Southwest or in California, your experience is much more of a Mexican-American, Chicano experience. So a lot of it has to do with what your exposure is, what your vantage point is. Some of that is geographic. Some of that is demographic. And
so because you tend to see a lot more Mexican or Central American in California, in LA, mm-hmm. that's what they envision.
Yep.
All right. Before I run out of time, I wanted to ask you, you've said that being transparent is something very important to you, and you're very transparent with your work on social media. We live in this time, we're being attacked constantly, especially by the president, by other people in government. You hear that phrase over and over again, fake news. But I'm curious, how do you tie, you know, being transparent on social media to the work that you're doing? Why is that so important to you? And how do you do that? What does that mean to you? How would you define being transparent? What are you showing?
What I like to show is a bit of the process. And in as much as that is about undermining this fake news narrative, is also about the fact that I know I have a lot of young journalists who follow me on these platforms, and that there's a little bit of magic to what we do. And I think sometimes people don't want to be completely candid about their process. So for me, I try to show how I'm finding people, who I'm interviewing, how I prep for some of those interviews, the questions that I ask. I'll even source questions from people who follow me on social media to get a sense of what the audience themselves is curious about. So it's trying to make it a much more holistic, integrative process.
So I said fake news, you started laughing. So, I mean, I wanted to get your sense of what all that means to you and what's going on right now.
Right. I mean, there are two pieces of it, right? There is legitimate fake news, which is to say the ways in which that some of the social platforms have been controlled and sites have been manipulated to look as though they are pushing narratives that are not in fact true. And then there is real news from reputable news sources that is being called fake news. It is a dangerous attack. It is a dangerous time in which we're living, in which, you know, you have to look at the source of your news and you have to trust some of these institutions that have proven themselves to be credible over a long period
of time. So do you think that's what we have to do? We have to basically just show everybody what the behind the scenes so they understand what we do as news media, right?
I think there's a piece of it that's that, but I think the bigger thing is to be really committed to the facts, really committed to double and triple checking, and being willing to stand by the product that you put out.
All right, I can't let you go without asking you this. You got a book coming out, right?
I have a book that I need to hand in to my editor.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, no, we've been looking for it. So is there anything you could tell us?
Yes. I'm looking at likability and what women who want to lead in the workplace face when it comes to wanting to be liked by the people that they worked with, but also being seen as a commanding and effective leader, and the challenges that women are up against.
So when it's out, please let us know.
Yes, please.
All right. We were looking for it, so let us know. Alicia Menendez, again, she is a contributor to Bustle Magazine, the host of the podcast Latina to Latina, also a contributor co-host to Amanpour and Company on PBS. Alicia, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It. All right, still to come, we're going to meet two Puerto Rican business owners who were forced to restart here in Miami. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miami is home to a large number of Puerto Rican immigrants after Hurricane Maria, and many are proving their resilience here in the face of catastrophe. Ivan Nieves and David Torres found their resilience through food. La Social, their family restaurant, which was also a boutique hair salon, was seriously damaged by the hurricane, and their apartment complex in Puerto Rico, located next to the shore, was completely overpowered by water winds. And Nieves' grandfather, who was crippled with prostate cancer, was unable to receive medical attention. Nieves and Torres made the hard choice of leaving their beloved city, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and they found a home for themselves in Miami. They started a new version of their cafe and bistro, La Social, in Miami, and they hoped this would be a beginning of a new life that would help them support their families back at home. Now, the restaurant has been welcomed in Miami by the Puerto Rican community, and we began a conversation with them at their place about the recovery after the storm.
What was left? That's a hard question. So it was hard after Hurricane Maria. A lot of things changed. It was even harder to go out of the door and just like seeing so much people outside. But like, it was like, what are we going to do now? There was no electricity, no water. We lost the apartment that we had, like the one that we were living on it on King Square Avenue. We were on the 12th floor, and because that was one of the like oldest buildings in the neighborhood. There were no other building as high as that one. So our 12th floor apartment, it was completely fuelless of the water. So you were like able to see the whole beach and the whole coast. So imagine like the complete storm going through the windows and just bringing everything from the outside to the inside. The water, salt, like it was crazy. ACs were inside of the bathrooms, like everything. So it was hard just to go in. We didn't spend the hurricane, at least the day of the hurricane, inside of the apartment because we knew it was going to be like something like not good. But we spent the hurricane on the building of the La Social in a friend's apartment. Either way, we finished going down to La Social, to the bunker, as we call it, just to spend the whole day over there because it was too strong.
And there was no power for a while. I mean, so did that mean there was no business? There was nothing you could do? I mean, what was going on in those days after?
Right after the hurricane, there wasn't any power for 4 months. In the beginning, the first 2 weeks, there was a generator in the building that we were able to use. And we started opening for a few hours a day, and we had coffee and grilled cheese sandwiches. Basically, what we needed power was for a refrigerator, so we could keep everything in good condition, but we had everything else we were making with gas. But after the generator blew up 2 weeks into it, and we had a really hard time finding people to fix it, finding parts for it. So after that, it wasn't really smart to try to keep opening, because we would buy inventory and then we would lose it. That we had no refrigerator again. So at that point, 2 weeks after the hurricane, we decided to stop the operation completely until the electricity came back, and then we would, I don't know, think about what we could do to see if we could actually open again or if we had to stay closed.
And, yeah, how long did it take, and what was it that finally really, I guess, forced you guys, like a lot of people, to say, we got to leave the island and we're going to have to go try somewhere else?
After we couldn't get any power from the generator or anything, we couldn't continue living in our apartment because it had no windows, it had no electricity, it was on the top floor, so it really wasn't in a livable condition anymore. We couldn't find anywhere else to live because everything was either destroyed like ours, or if it wasn't, there was somebody living there already. So we tried looking for other places to move to. We couldn't find anything. So Ivan's cousin lives here in North Miami, so that's what started it all. We're like, okay, then he had to come here with his grandparents because they're cancer patients, and their doctor left. So they had to come here to get some treatment here so they could continue, it wouldn't be stopped. So Ivan came, and that's what we started looking into, like, let's just move to Miami. Like, we really have, if we open La Social again, we'll figure it out later, but for now, we have to move. We have nowhere to live here. So it took me about a month after Ivan left to travel to Miami, because we have two dogs. And to travel with the dogs, you need a certificate that the dogs are in good health. You need, so all this paperwork I couldn't come up with. And then once we moved, we didn't know what was gonna happen there.
Real quickly, I wanted to ask you, Ivan, about, you know, because we were talking about, you know, how long you were there before you guys finally decided you couldn't stay. And for you, I mean, there were some family issues as well.
Yeah, I think after Hurricane, we were able to open 2 weeks, La Social, right? So after that, generator blew off. So everything was like, again, it was like starting again. So let's see how we go. And then we had this situation with my grandfather's, and he was like, okay, so what's the next step? Because since our doctor is leaving right now, probably half of the island doctors are leaving too. So it's just like, that's nothing we can, like, that's not on our hands. So we have to find a solution for that. So that's when we realized that we had to do, like, some moving, and we needed to do something quick, because if not, it was going to be, like, really, really hard. At that point, airplanes and even the airport, it was, like, really chaotic, because some people were able to get flights really fast. But at the second week, it was, like, everyone was thinking about leaving. So at that point, it was like, or you get a flight now, or you're going to stay. Or you get a flight now, or you're going to stay. So I think that was when we realized, and we bought up three flights, one for me and two for my grandmother and grandfather. And that's definitely when we said, like, where's the closest and easiest point to just move and, like, get help for them. And then we organized. Let's just do the jump, whichever spot is easier. And we got a cousin over here that lives in Miami, in North Miami. And I called her, so like, is it a possibility that we just, like, go over there? I don't have to sleep over there, but grandmother, grandfather need a spot. And she was welcoming enough to, I stay over there for almost a month or two. But yeah, that's definitely when we realized that we needed to do something about it.
What's going on right now in Puerto Rico? Is that place still going or no?
It's 100%. It's 100% working right now. We were able to rent it to Fabiana. She's doing a great job as a stylist. We have the boutique slowly but coming, and we got the juice bar, pastry shop, and bistro running. Weekends are top. They're brunch like nothing happened. I have to say, like, I feel like at the beginning we were doubting about people. Like, the customer is going to be there, we're going to be able to do sales. But at this point, I think what we understood about what everything happened and everything, like, has been going on, it's just like people needed some safetiness, some, like, just to realize, like, what was left, or, like, what it was before having, like, completely gone, and we needed something just to attach to it, because at some point people were lost. It's just like, what am I going to do now? So I feel like La Social became that one of spot. Like, at least not everything changed. At least I got something that I feel safe, and I go over there and I can have meeting, I can hang out, I can just have fun. I just, like, whatever I need to do, I can go over there. It's just like a focal spot in Condado. It's not only for the locals, but it's for locals and tourists. But yeah, it's just like, it's a focal point. It's just like, and I feel like that's something that keeps us holding on. Like, we want to keep it going. I tried, like, it's been really hard because I travel every week over there. But I feel like that's one of, like, the main purpose that we're doing it, because, like, it's needed. Like, we need just people to realize, like, not everything is lost. Just, like, we're here, we're going to make it happen. Just, like, it's slowly, but it's coming.
So that place there in Puerto Rico is so important to the community. Have you recreated? I mean, this is obviously here. You don't have all the same things. It's a bit different situation. But what? How would you describe this location here in Miami compared to what you have in Puerto Rico? Are you trying to rebuild that here?
I feel like for us, it was really important. I think that was something that David was, like, pushing it since the beginning. We have to find a community where we can attach ourselves to. So I remember having one conversation when I was looking for spaces that we were saying, we should go to Weston, we should go to small community, we should go, like, where people, like, live together, but, like, they know each other, and, like, they go out every week and or every on the weekends. And it was weird because first of all, when I got here, everyone said, like, no, you should go to Brickell. No, you should go to Wynwood. No, you should go to Midtown. And we were, like, almost signing for Midtown. And when I got here, I got, like, we got this sense that we always, it's just, we have to feel it. It's not about, like, oh, it's square space and it's have the amount of space needed. But we, when we got here, this place was destroyed. But the tree, the area, it got us. So we said, like, you know what? It may happen. It's a possibility. And now we just realize, like, the Bellamy community, the Morningside community, like, this Mimo community is really, really, really close. So it feels almost like being a condado, because there's a lot of Latinos. There's a lot of, like, people from all over the world. And they just also needed a spot where they get together, where they meet. You can see it for now. Like, people out of, like, the kids go out of school and this is a meeting point. Dad goes out of work and they meet over here. So that's what we're looking for. We don't like that, like, I don't know. We're not a franchise build business. So we needed, we also encouraged to have that family relationship. So it's not only about just the business, it's just the relationship that we create with the customer. So for that, it's really important for us just to have that ambience.
How often do you get to talk to other Puerto Ricans like you who had to leave and come here? And I just want to get a sense of what they're telling you. Do they long for that, the chance to go back? Or have they just accepted, you know what, maybe I can't go back. It's just never going to work. I got to stay here and just start over.
We meet Puerto Ricans every day here, like every single day. Puerto Ricans in our same situation that had to leave are usually, at least in the area here in Miami, they're usually professionals, doctors, lawyers, bankers. And yeah, they had to leave because the situation in the island couldn't live there anymore. They didn't have a job anymore. We knew a lot of people in retail. Their stores closed completely, so they had to be relocated to other places in the United States. And yes, there's always the homesick aspect of it. But the reality is that we have to have jobs, and until the island is not up to where it was, and until the economy is not back to where it was, it's going to be really hard for a lot of those people to go back, because they can go back, but they really don't have a job to go back to. And how do you support your family, and how do you become keep becoming better and better and better if you don't have, yeah.
It's funny, though, because we even get people that has been here for 25 years and said, like, oh, how's things happening? How's, like, we want to go back, but we're here. So, no, it's funny. I think, like, that's one of the things of Puerto Rican. Like, we create our family no matter where we are. So I feel like that's what it makes us really, like, as a community, really, like, what we are. It's been a couple hard months for everyone, who, like, the ones that stay, the ones that go, the ones that has been living for, like, doesn't matter if you're in the United States or not. I think the hope and the, like, communication that we get every time is just, like, we're holding on, we're trying to help those who stay, making our effort to do the best as we can. And definitely we're missing home. We're going to miss home, like, doesn't matter when or where, just, like, we're gonna miss it. That's how it works, right? Doesn't matter where you, like, where you come from, but if you're Puerto Rican, you're gonna miss your island. That's how it works.
That was Ivan Nieves and David Torres, owners of La Social in Miami. They have one in San Juan, and you can find some of the pictures from their shop on our Facebook at WLRN Sundial. By the way, they have a tasty mango salsa to dip your chips in. Oh, all right. Well, Heat fans have waited for months for an answer. Three-time NBA champion and 12-time NBA All-Star Dwayne Wade has taken all summer to decide whether or not to retire or come back. He posted a video yesterday on YouTube to make his announcement, and he kind of teased us.
So this decision is not easy. It's not. And I've asked myself why and why not and what not and all these things.
Well, the video took almost 10 minutes, and through tears, he finally got to his answer.
I feel it's right to ask you guys to join me for one last dance, for one last season. This is it. I've given this game everything that I have, and I'm happy about that. And I'm going to give it for one last season, everything else I have left.
Dwayne Wade is back for one more year. You can find us on Facebook again at WLRN Sundial. We have a post up there. Tell us, what does this mean for you as a fan? What does it mean for the team? And what does it mean for the city and for South Florida? And, of course, on the topic of local sports, we should note, starting this Thursday, we're beginning a series of conversations about high school football in South Florida, beginning with a chat about concussions. Stay tuned for that. Well, that's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.